Listener production.
Hi, and thank you once again for joining us on Listener for Everything Southwest and our series on local legends. It's Cliff here, and this lady is a legend, a hero, and I think probably not far off being canonised for her work in the medical community in and around Bunbury and the Southwest too. Professor Samar Aoun has been named as the winner of the WA 2023 Australian of the Year Award. I voted for you for Australian of the Year too, by the way. I tried to get you through there. Samar is Perrin Institute Research Chair in Palliative Care at the University of Western Australia, Head of Palliative Care Research at the Perrin Institute, and is the Chair of Southwest Compassionate Communities Network, which is trying to make us talk a little more, think a little more, a lot more, in fact, about death and dying, because nobody gets a pass. Professor Samar Aoun, hello, welcome, and thank you for coming in.
It's my pleasure, Cliff.
I hope I got everything right there.
I don't know about the canonized bit. That's too much.
A bridge too far, maybe one day. But your work has been absolutely groundbreaking. And I want to talk to you as, firstly, we're going to do two segments for the podcast here. We're going to talk more about death and dying coming up. But I want to get some more of the Samar story. How did a young lady from Lebanon via London finish up in Bunbury for all of these years?
That's fate, I think. I'm the type who's very open-minded, so I was, I'm interested in anything that makes a difference to the community in general. So this is the way things happened for us. Lebanon was in a state of war for 20 years, and so we went to London. I did my PhD there. My husband did his furthering his medical degree. My kids were born there, and then the situation was still so bad in Lebanon. All of my husband's family, they're here. So they kept saying, why don't you come to Australia? So we came, and it was a really great move, you know, to raise the kids away from bombs and, you know, all the misery that still the Lebanese people are going through. And so we're really lucky. It's a blessing that we made Australia home. And from there, it's just I was very involved in community work, you know, in Bunbury to start off with. And then more at the state level, and then more at the national level, and then got into also the international scene for the work that I was involved in. So that's my journey. I haven't planned any of it, except that where is it I can make a difference? That was at the, you know, forefront of my mind all the time.
What are your enduring memories of Lebanon?
It's a beautiful country, and the Lebanese people are beautiful people. They're so hospitable. They're so warm. And I might say, in normal circumstances, they do death well. One of those cultures that actually know exactly how to grieve, how to mourn, how to support people who are caring, dying, and grieving. But it's life has really been hard on Lebanese people with all the political turmoil. You know, we try to help as much as possible whenever, you know. But yeah, we can do whatever we can from outside. The country hasn't really moved on very much in all these years. So thankfully, the kids were raised here and they're, you know, beautiful citizens of this country. And life goes on, really.
The situation in Lebanon, as you say, has been really, really horrible for a long time. Seeing that and thinking, someone's got to make a change to do this better. I mean, let's not talk about the war and all of that sort of stuff, but the suffering and the community. Was there a moment when it struck you that we got to do this better? Or was it sort of, did it grow and then one day there was a spark?
Having lived in Lebanon during the war, during our adolescent years, we had no choice how we died. We faced our mortality every minute of the day, you know. But honestly, we had four choices how you die, whether a car bomb or a sniper fire, or if you go to an area that's not of your religious affiliation, where your fate is sealed there, basically. So that's really was really hard to take as you're growing up, in terms of we're not living, we're surviving, and we're just thinking, when are we going to die next? So that sort of left all that in my heart, I suppose. You know, and then coming to Australia and, you know, seeing the choices that people can exercise here and the values that they can. But sometimes they're not making the most of that. Being in a peaceful country, how can you make things better, you know, for people who are dying, grieving, you know? So it sort of affected me unconsciously, I suppose, the living in Lebanon. And of course, the other thing that's affected me, like fast forward, you know, when I was here, I had a call that my father died, and I was going to work to chair a research meeting. So I called to let them know why I'm going to be late, because I needed to book a ticket, because they told me you must come quickly. We don't wait that long to bury our dead there. And so after I, you know, did what I need to do, I went to the office, to the meeting, and none of my colleagues said anything. I was devastated. Like, I've lost a dear, dear person, and they didn't even acknowledge that. I don't think they did it because on purpose, but I think they felt awkward. They didn't know what to say. And that's the majority of the community. But I mean, these were health professionals, and you think health professionals maybe could do it better, but not necessarily, you see, than the lay person in the community. And then, of course, the next day I was on the flight, and then I was overwhelmed by the love, the affection of my community where I lived, you know, how they've taken care of everything. I felt I was carried on a cloud of love. Really, it was surreal, the feeling that I was feeling. And so when I came back on the flight, I was saying, this is it. Death, dying, loss and grief belong to the community. They do it well. It is everyone's responsibility. It's not the responsibility of the health services. It is a community event. Death is a social event. It's not a medical event.
I want to get to that, especially with palliative care too.
Yes, exactly.
So it was your dad who lit the spark.
It did, honestly. Yeah, so when I came back, I thought, we need to do something. It's not okay for people to ignore someone who is grieving. He did. He did. And honestly, it's 11 years on Australia Day when I was on the flight, you know, to his burial. So,
bless him. Tell me about Southwest Compassionate Communities. Hasn't been around for that long. You're the chair.
2018.
Yeah. What was the spark for that? Again, was it, you know, like a sort of a, not a culmination of what you'd been thinking about and working on, but was there something that happened within Bunbury and you went, oh man, we've got to do this better?
Well, it's a continuation of all that feeling. So my research has been on bereavement support. And it showed that 90% of people get their bereavement support from their families, their neighbors, their loved ones. You don't need to go to a health professional. It's only the 10% that have complicated grief that end up, you know, needing professional support. So Compassionate Communities is an international movement about getting the community more involved in end-of-life care or any other care, really. But we're focusing being from the palliative care world. So the research that I've done in bereavement support was very well taken at the international level, because that was the first quantitative evidence that compassionate communities work for bereavement support. Like, nobody knew that, you know, really, this is how many people are involved in supporting people. So then, you know, my colleagues at the international scene started, you know, asking me to come and present, and, you know, they were even themselves promoting that evidence in research that we were able to get, that compassionate communities is not just a lovey-dovey approach. It works. And I'll tell you later how it's worked in the Southwest.
I'm interested to know how you quantify that. You say that you've got data, you've got the research to show that it works. How do you do that?
So this is it. Go to the people and ask them. There's no other way of knowing what matters to people unless you go and ask them. So we had a national survey, 1,000 people responded, and the experiences were just, wow, you know, like, people wanted to talk about their grief and what's worked for them and didn't. And then so we found out that most of them, the majority, this is who they relied on. And also they relied on funeral providers, which we didn't know until then either, how much they valued how the funeral providers could support them. So we asked them the next question: how helpful was it for you? And again, 90% said their families, friends, neighbors, funeral providers were really helpful, and more of the health professionals were unhelpful. So that was really quite interesting to know. And, you know, things took off from there. And it was very helpful for health professionals to know themselves that they don't need to counsel every person who has a death in their family. The community takes care of this. They need to really encourage them to make the most of their social networks. Mm. Only when it's like a really traumatic death, a suicide, a huge accident, something that people are not prepared for, yep, well, this is where sometimes the trauma lasts for much longer and we call it complicated grief. So I think it's changed the way we do now grieving. And I think a lot of the health services felt relieved that we can't look after everyone. We don't need to look after everyone in the community who has a death. So we know now where to put our resources. Mm. And that's changed the way how it's done all over the world, really.
And you're looking at a charter with the city of Bunbury. What is that going to involve and how will that work within the community?
Yeah, so again, through compassionate communities, a lot of countries or cities like Ottawa, like Bern, like Köln, have pledged to become a compassionate city. And that is bringing all the sectors together, you know, whether the arts sector, the schools, the young people, the aged, the faith organizations, all come together to actually talk and discuss what is it for us, what do we need to act in a more compassionate way and to talk in a more compassionate way. So we've done the first round of consultations with the city. We're working with the city of Bunbury here. Mm. And we have now a draft and we're sending it again for consultation so that people comment, okay, this is how we want our city to be. And this is how we're going to basically now make sure that, say, schools would have some guidelines on how to support someone, a child or a parent or a teacher who's either caring for someone, dying from life-limiting illness, mm, or grieving. Because, again, people don't know what to do. Again, yep, we will have a big forum on compassionate workplaces. How can you support an employee? You know, so employers need to have all this education in place, mm, which they don't have, so that when they meet someone, they just, I mean, it's simple what you say. It's not like really rocket science.
Exactly.
But still, I think it's the emotion that takes hold of people and they just, they become mum, you know, they just can't. I mean, it's happened to me as well before, mm, I got into this field. So it's not easy.
Yeah. I would bet that there'd be three words, Sama, that wrap up your work and your thought process. And that would be talk about it.
Yes.
We don't. In Western society, we don't. None of us gets out of here with the pass. We're all going to close our eyes for the last time sometime. But if we don't think about it, we don't have to think about it. So is that the bottom line? Talk about it?
Yes. And that's one of the role of the Compassionate Community Network, to actually get those conversations happening in the community in a nice, guided way so that people feel safe, they can open up, they can talk about the person who they've lost, how they can have support more. Create, you know, their networks around them, you know, get people, come on, you know, you can help with this, you know, because a lot of people have got the lived experience, you, mm, know, we've got a lot of assets in our community who can be part of having those conversations, guiding people. And again, we have a major, major event usually in August called Dying to Know Day. Mm. And usually we have a lot of the death literacy and grief literacy happens there. And again, having visits to the cemetery and crematoria so that people can go and see what it's like, mm, instead of, you know, not knowing what's going to happen to them, and having the choices. People need to die according to their values and choices. And unfortunately, too many Australians are not dying in a way and in a place that fits with their values and choices. But if you don't have those conversations, nobody will know what are your values and your choices.
Exactly,
you know?
Yeah.
So, and again, advanced care planning is, again, something big that the health department is trying to promote. And you can put this on writing, you know. This is what I want to happen to me. This is the kind of treatment I don't want. This, mm, is who I want, you know, who to be around me, you know, when I die. This is how I want to be buried. It's a whole, like, a lot of choices that you can have.
Oh, there's,
know,
a lot of variables that you can have. I'm wondering, though, we are now in the 21st century, more connected than we've ever been. Technology, all of that sort of stuff. And yet, we are more disconnected. How do you get on with lots of people who live alone? Maybe they don't have family. Maybe they are older themselves and their friends and other relatives have already passed away. How do you get to that area of the community?
And that's exactly why we trialed what we call a compassionate connector program in partnership with the health service, the palliative care services and the chronic disease care services. So they've referred to the program families so that our beautiful connectors help them with what they need and start those end-of-life care conversations with them. And 50% of those families were home alone, were home alone in across the Southwest. It's not like they don't have families or kids, but again, they're disconnected from them. So what we've done and the connectors have done, they've connected them back into their own communities. So if you don't have naturally occurring networks, they manage to facilitate external networks for them. So, you know, have somebody who doesn't have to be related to them to come and walk the dog for them or prepare a meal or take them to their medical appointment. So it worked very well. And, you know, when you look at the evidence, of course, we use a very scientific tool to look at their social connectedness before and after. And we've almost doubled the networks of those people, you know, that were there. So this is what I mean. We have a lot of people in the community who want to help, but they don't know how because of all this privacy, confidentiality stuff that keeps them away. We have a lot of people in the community who need help, but they're too scared to ask for help. And you know, it's okay to ask for help because all of us, we're going to be somewhere in this position. It's not a taboo. It's not a stigma if you have a life-limiting illness. And so many of them have. So, you know, ask for help. It's only when you ask for help, you will open the social networks around you and then people will come and help you. But as soon as you're asked and you say, oh, no, I'm fine, that's it. You've really killed it around you. Nobody's going to come back and ask you if you need help.
Yeah, that's very difficult. And that's a big barrier to break down. In Western society, we have Are You OK Day. We have all of that sort of stuff. Triple M does a lot with Beyond Blue. But, you know, hey, how you going? Oh, I'm having an absolute shocker. A lot of people are just going to go, click. Oh, God, why did I ask? But that's the person who needs to have the conversation. They need it because they might be alone. And there's few worse things than loneliness, I think. And that's very difficult when you are at end of life.
Do you know that is the biggest killer in general, whether you are end of life or not? Now, big trials, international trials have showed those who have strong social relationships tend to live longer, have a better health, which is mental or physical, and they're happier in life. And the opposite is true for those who don't have any social relationships. So you could have two people with the same disease, but one is really socially active, one is not. You bet that one with the socially active is feeling much better, able to cope better with their disease and live longer than the other one who's basically,
I remember the song, People Who Need People Are the Happiest People in the World.
That's a good one, actually.
Barbara Streisand had the hit. It's probably from a music. Write it down. I can't claim it. I don't know who wrote it, whether it was Leslie Bricusse or maybe Sondheim. I don't know. But that's the song. People Who Need People Are the Happiest People in the World. Look, we've got so many things to have a talk about. We'll probably be here for the next couple of days. So I'll get you another cup of tea. And there's many, many things that we want to have a talk about because the work is something I think the time has come to start talking about this this issue. Samar Aoun, Professor, thank you for being with us. You are most definitely a Southwest local legend. We'll work on that canonisation thing. I know people. I'm not sure, but we'll see. For now, thank you so much for being with us and have a very pleasant time. And we'll catch up with you again to talk more about death and dying and how we can do it better. Even saying that, there's probably people listening going, what? How on earth do we do that? But we're going to get to it next time around on Everything Southwest. Samar, thank you so much indeed.
Thank you very much, Cliff.
And there's more to come.
A Listener production.